Hey everybody, welcome back. We're going to talk about in this video the Butte, Montana copper mine. This is a case study that kind of gets you prepared for a lot of what we'll be discussing in this class. Okay, we'll be going into different aspects of this kind of larger feature, this copper mine, from what's actually there, which is copper ore. Okay, very important. Metal that is used all over the world for many different things, but it also talks about the environmental implications and how this has affected the community, specifically in Butte, Montana, and sort of a cautionary tale, if you will, in terms of how mining should proceed in the future, why regulation is important, but also why copper itself, which is what's coming from this mine, is important. It's an important mineral that's used in many things. So we're going to talk about these different aspects of this one mineral. And again, as we move through the course, we'll be talking about this in terms of a lot of different types of minerals. There's so many different things that come from the earth that are useful, that are mined, that provide energy, et cetera. And we'll be going into each of these in detail. So this is just kind of a taste. This is sort of an example of one of the things that we'll be approaching and how we'll be coming at it from so many different perspectives, a geologic perspective, a society, environmental perspective, et cetera. So the Berkeley Pit is what you see in the background here. This is talked about in both the other videos you'll be watching, the CBS News video and the Business Insider video, which deals with the environmental side, specifically as birds are coming in. But you can see the city of Butte is right here. I'm kind of circling it. And it is right on the edge of this copper mine. This is what is the Berkeley Pit, this lake here. Okay, when mining was occurring, there was no water in this lake. They had to have pumps that were way down deep at the bottom of this open pit that were pumping groundwater out. Water as it would seep into the pit, they would pump it out in order to keep the caverns and all those mining shafts free of water so they could actually do the mining. Then when mining stopped at some point, this ended up filling back up with water very slowly. Groundwater was seeping in, and I believe it happened at about the rate of about a foot a month or so. And today it is a large lake that is toxic, right? It is toxic to birds, it's toxic to humans, any life, and so very much a problem. So it is about a mile long. It's a 900-foot deep lake. It is a vast network of contaminated subterranean tunnels, again, which are the old mine shafts. And this constitutes, or did at least, constitute the nation's largest Superfund site. So a Superfund site is a location where it's been determined that there is significant environmental degradation, and the government, federal government, in partnership with locals, public and private sector, are working over a very long period of time to clean it up. Environmental remediation is going on. Butte, Montana itself, which is pictured here, has been called the most mined city in the world. Much of the world's copper once came from here. It was pretty much shut down in the 1980s, and then pretty much arguments ensued on who was going to pay for and mitigate the damage. So on the Buttes, on the town's east side, so that's what we're looking at here where the mine is the east side of the town. You can see the terrace scars remain. The water, you can see, is sort of an interesting color here. It's laden with heavy metals. It kills migrating flocks of snow geese, which, again, you'll learn about in the other video. There's all sorts of efforts to prevent birds from landing there, which I'll let you learn about in the other video. But nearly $1 billion has been spent to stabilize the mine tailings, cap them, plant over many of the waste sites, so in remediation generally. Way back in the day in the 1860s is when prospectors started working this area, so it has a very long history. They've also mined silver from this. They've also mined gold. And tens of thousands of immigrants ultimately were drawn to this area in order to work these mines. And by the late 1800s, as American homes, businesses, and factories were being electrified, Butte was supplying more than half of the copper needed for that wiring. And at its peak, 10,000 men worked in the mines here. They transported hundreds of thousands of feet below the earth's surface to send back up its minerals. There are strikes, labor strikes, as well as lowering prices of copper, which slowed down the industry, which at some point was controlled by the Anaconda Copper Mining Company. They sold their holdings to ARCO, which is a division of an oil company, BP, which many people are probably familiar with. And then several years later, they suspended all mining. So it pretty much stopped around 1980. So yeah, the water in the mine is very acidic. It's about the same acidity as distilled vinegar. There were about 300 million tons of copper ore that had been extracted from this pit over its lifespan. And of course, left behind this very large pit that you can see. So just sort of a side note, which I mentioned that this was worked primarily by immigrants throughout its history, especially 1800s, early 1900s. Employment opportunities in the mines, they attracted surges of Asian and European immigrants, particularly Irish, interestingly. And as of 2017, Butte has the largest population of Irish Americans per capita in any city of the United States. So that's sort of a testament to that immigrant history working these mines. So that is Butte. That is the copper mine here. I'm going to move on. And let's look at sort of where copper is being pulled from throughout the world. So it's ultimately widespread, right? You see copper all over the world. And we're going to look at how it forms at least a little bit. But you can see throughout the Western United States, you have many copper mines. And there's many different types here, which you can see in the legend here, from porphyry, copper skarn, volcanogenic, massive sulfide. So these are really fancy words. And again, we'll look in sort of look at a very general model, at least, of how copper forms. But ultimately, you can notice that it kind of goes along this trend here, all these locations. Okay, this is also known as the Ring of Fire, right? This sort of runs from South America here up to Central America, North America. The Ring of Fire, of course, is called that because it is a string of volcanoes. Okay, so that should tell you something. There's something about volcanoes and even the word volcanogenic, right, is in the legend here, massive sulfide deposits, right? So volcanoes are playing a role in terms of where copper is deposited, but it exists all throughout the world, Australia, throughout Southeast Asia, some parts of Central Asia, even in Europe. Cyprus, which is shown here, right? This is an island in the Mediterranean. It's actually named after copper, interestingly, right? So copper's been around for a pretty long time, And yeah, some of the questions that we will address in terms of copper, but also in terms of a lot of the minerals that we're talking about in this class are, number one, where do they come from, right? How do they get concentrated wherever they occur in the earth? Because the key to a place where you're going to mine it is that is a place where you have concentrations of that mineral. Okay, so why is it concentrated in certain locations? What is the process that's concentrating these minerals? And we're gonna talk about that. Also, how do we find them? How do we figure out where these are in the first place? And then lastly, I've mentioned this word more than once now, but what is an ore mineral, right? So those are some of the questions that we'll address. And let's look at copper. Now, copper is concentrated in the earth, in the earth's crust, which is this outer layer, solid layer on the earth, right? It's concentrated in many ways. And this is just one model, okay? And in this one model, you can see that there's many things going on. It's even complicated. But there are other models also for how copper forms. So it exists kind of in many different environments. But this is one. I mean, it's known as the volcanic intrusive environment, which is labeled down here, right? Of base metal deposits. So copper is just one of many base metals. And some others are listed here, like lead, in zinc, in iron, etc., right? And so what's happening? Well, generally you have, see these darker shapes here? These represent magma bodies, okay? So this is where the volcano piece comes in, right? Because you have magma bodies that are intruding into the crust, these hot masses, literally of magma, hot material. And what that does is it drives circulation of groundwater. Okay, you get water that comes from the magma itself, small amounts, But you also get water that comes in from the surface, right? We call that meteoric water, water that's coming from precipitation onto the surface, infiltrating in, and then becoming groundwater. Okay, so when that groundwater moves around and interacts with this hot magma body, ultimately it heats it up and it causes circulation. Okay, that's called convection, right? So that groundwater starts convecting and moving around in the subsurface. As it does so, in some places, it's going to dissolve metals and different minerals, and in other places it's going to precipitate different minerals and metals. And so what it's doing, that water is concentrating, right, certain metals and minerals in the subsurface, and that's exactly what's happening in these intrusions. It's heating up the water, causing convection of that groundwater move around, which means that you have some of it dissolving and then some of it precipitating elsewhere. And where it's precipitating, that's where we're getting our copper deposits. Okay, so let's continue on. This image, by the way, it comes out of one of the textbooks, the Kessler and Simon textbook. Okay, so let's continue on. This is an example of chalcopyrite. It is the most common ore of copper. So now we haven't really defined the word ore yet. Ore is an economic concentration, let's say, of a mineral on the subsurface. So where you have enough of that mineral concentrated that it is economic to mine it. Okay, if there's not enough concentrated there, then it's not an ore. Because you can have copper dispersed in the subsurface, right, in the rocks, in just a very, very low concentration to where it's not economic to mine it. And that would therefore not be an ore, even though there's copper there. Okay, it has to be concentrated enough that you can go in there and you can dig it up, and then it's economic to do so. Okay, that makes an ore mineral. Chalcopyrite, which has a chemical formula of Cu, that's copper, Fe, which is iron, and then S2, which is sulfur. Okay, so it's got copper, iron, and sulfur in it. It is a mineral, and ultimately it has enough copper that you can, if you can remove that iron and sulfur, right, then you have your native copper, and that's what you're kind of going for. So oftentimes the ore mineral is chalcopyrite, not always, but it's one of the more common ones out there. Okay, this would be an image of native copper. So this is either as it happens to precipitate in the subsurface, it can happen, or what it might start to look like after you refine it, right, after you run it through some processing to isolate the copper. Right, so let's look at the history of copper a little bit. Copper, again, its chemical formula is Cu, or its chemical symbol, I should say. So 5,600 years ago, copper was used primarily for weapons in the Middle East. That's sort of the historic record. 5,000 years ago, so just a little bit later, people figured out, hey, we can combine this with tin to make an alloy, right? An alloy is ultimately multiple metals that have been mixed together to create a new one. And this creates bronze. So bronze is a combination of tin and copper. Okay, and that was the beginning of the Bronze Age. Bronze is just stronger. Okay, it's a stronger metal, so it ended up being more useful. Also, I've note here that if you combine copper with zinc, right, that creates another alloy, brass, which is something that most people are probably familiar with. Ultimately, brass, bronze, copper, very popular up until about 3,000 years ago when people figured out, hey, iron is even more useful, right? It's not quite as brittle. It's more useful. So then copper became a bit less popular at that time. But then it was revived during the Industrial Age, so much more recently, because it has unique electrical properties, right? It's very conductive. Okay, electricity can pass through it, which is why you get copper in a lot of motors, generators, and wiring, right? You can get electric signals moving through copper. Brass, more commonly today, is used for ammunition. And just sort of an interesting fact, cars, okay, contain about 25 kilograms of copper and a length of 1 kilometer of wiring. It's a lot of wiring. It's a very long distance, right? That's in a car. That's in a typical vehicle, Okay, so we are still using quite a bit of copper today, whether it's in wiring, whether it's in all sorts of different devices that we use, but it's still a very useful useful metal. And so something that is still very actively mined throughout the world. So let's look at where it is mined and what that looks like. Okay, this is the largest copper mine in the world. It is in Chile, and it's called the Escondida copper mine. You can see here is an image of it. Just sort of interesting fact is that 98% of the rock that's pulled out of these open pit mines, which is typically how copper is mined, is discarded. So is waste, waste rock, and it's put into what we call tailings. Okay, so the tailings would be the pile of waste rock that you pull out that's not the copper ore, not the stuff that you're looking for. Okay, normally these pits, once they're finished, they are not refilled. Why? You could always take your tailings, right, and put it back into the pit and fill it up. Well, it's because when the mining is done, there's no more money to be made. And so somebody would have to pay for that, right? And people are like, hey, I'm not going to pay for it. I'm not making money off of this pit. So they just don't do it. You know, you could make an argument that, hey, if you're going to dig a mine, you should be putting money aside so that you can pay to have that thing filled up later on. That's not currently how things are done. I'm going to go ahead and jump out of here for a second because I want to see where this is out at in the real world. So let's go into Google. We're going to go to Google Maps just for a moment here. Okay, and here we are. So this is actually the Berkeley Pit. So I'm in Montana. Let's zoom out so you can see where we're at. Okay, so now you can see the entire west here. That's Butte right in the center of the screen. Portland is way over here. So if we continue over past Idaho, we find ourselves in Butte, Montana. So let's go ahead and zoom back in. If you've ever driven on the 90, Interstate 90, which comes through Washington State and then continues all the way across the United States, you drive right through Butte. I didn't know anything about Butte, but I happened to be driving across the country. It was actually when I was going to grad school, and we drove by here, and I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, there's a town sitting on the side of this open pit mine, total insanity. That was sort of my introduction to Butte, right? But you can see, okay, so this would be the Berkeley Pit. It's labeled here as well, right? And then you have, see the tailings pond up here. So this is the tailings, right? This is a big pile. This is where they put all the waste rock that they pulled out of this pit. They put it over here, and you actually have a little lake here that's formed on the north side of that. You can see there's a lot of digging that happened here. You get sort of these terraced edges, very typical of open pit mining, and then the town, again, right on the edge of that. Okay. Okay, let's go see. Let's see if we can find the Escondido mine, which is all the way down in Chile. So I'm going to zoom out here. I'm going to continue down to the south. There's Mexico, Central America, right? We're going down south towards Chile, which is down here. Okay, I'm not exactly sure where it is in here. I'm going to just see if we can see it. I could always do a search for it if I can't find it quickly. Let's see here. The Escondido mine, what I'm looking for here is going to be kind of like the Berkeley Pit. So you see this interesting feature right here? This looks like it might be an open pit that's filled with water, a lake, and even a tailings pond sticking out on this side. Is it? Am I right? Oh, no, I'm not. That's oftentimes what they look like. Let's continue north here. Yeah, I may just do a Google search for it here. Oh, there we go. Found it. Mina Escondida. Okay, so look, here's a tailings pond. Same type of thing. I don't know if our satellite image is going to... There it is. It's nice and clear. So this is your tailings pond here to the south. Okay, if we go to the north, we're probably going to find an open pit. So this is the Escondida mine in Chile, the largest open pit copper mine in the world. You can see that there's a lot of different parts to it. Here's a pit here. You have additional digging that happened over here. So this one's spread out over quite a large area. Okay, here's another pit over here to the south. It just keeps going and going. This is a huge, huge mine. Okay, and you can see more tailings exist up here to the north. It's waste rock, right? So that's Escondida, and you can see we're in the middle of the desert out here, the Atacama Desert in Chile. You know, there are multiple copper mines throughout Chile. One is going to be here near Calama. If I go to the north, you can see that there is another open pit mine right here. So these exist all over the place in the desert in Chile. Let's go ahead and search now. Actually, I can get there myself. I'm going to come back up to the United States. So I'm going through South America, Central America, Mexico, and we're going to go to Utah, okay, for the next one here, right near Salt Lake City. Okay, I'm zooming in, and see if you can notice where the open pit mine is as I go in a little bit closer here. You got Great Salt Lake up here, Utah Lake to the south. This is the city itself. Going to continue in. Do you see it yet? Oh, it's just off to the left of the screen over here. See that? I mean, this one here, this is another copper mine. Okay, it's the Bingham mine or the Kennecott mine. And you can see it's just outside of town here. But it's an old one. It's been here for a while. Let's zoom on in and take a look. And look at all these terraces. This is a massive one. It's a big, huge open pit. I mean, they ultimately just dug this mountain apart, didn't they? I mean, you can look around at these things in Google Earth yourself. Google Earth is pretty amazing. But yeah, you can see it's the Kennecott mine. Well, it looks like it might be owned by Rio Tinto, which is one of the largest mining companies in the world, maybe the largest. Let's go ahead and jump back to the presentation here. Okay, so we're looking at Escondida 1 second ago. Okay, and then from here, let's continue down to, so this is the Bingham, the Kennecott. This is the one we were just looking at in Google Earth here. And you can see there's a real interesting feature here on the side where you can see there was a failure, right? There's a landslide. This is one that actually occurred on April 10, 2013. This is at the Bingham Canyon Mine. It happened in the form of two separate rock avalanches that were about an hour and a half apart. This slide produced enough debris, okay, that came down and sort of filled the bottom here to bury New York City's Central Park in 66 feet. That's about 20 meters of debris. In total, 65 million cubic meters of material was deposited. Okay, it makes this cumulative event likely the largest non-volcanic landslide to have occurred in North America in modern times. Okay, say that one more time. It's the likely the largest non-volcanic landslide to have occurred in North America in modern times, and it was in the Bingham, or the what's now known as the Kennecott mine, here just outside of Salt Lake City, Utah. This is a copper mine. Okay, why do we say non-volcanic? Does anybody out there know what the largest volcanic landslide, the largest landslide is volcanic, in other words. And does anybody know what that might have been for North America? Okay, I'm going to make a guess. I think it was probably the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980, okay, where that entire mountainside just failed, ultimately, mass destruction. But yeah, so this is the Bingham Kennecott mine in Utah. We got copper mines, you know, multiple in North America here. It is the second largest supplier of copper in the United States, providing about 18 to 25% of all copper for the United States needs, at least. So still active today. Okay, so, you know, ultimately you have these open pit mines where you're pulling out this copper ore. So once you get that out of the ground, what do you do with it? Well, you have to further concentrate it. So nature did some of the job, right? Nature, through this sort of groundwater circulation that I mentioned earlier, right? The groundwater is moving around, dissolving copper in certain places and then precipitating it elsewhere. It's concentrating the copper naturally, okay? It's doing a lot of the job for us. We pull that out of the ground. Now we have to concentrate it even further, okay, before it becomes native copper, becomes useful. And that's done through refining or through smelting, right? And that's what we're looking at here. This is a smelting plant, okay, and it's outside of Salt Lake City, so this isn't far from the Bingham mine. And what they're doing is they're processing copper ore and they're concentrating it into copper, native copper. Ultimately, smelting, what does it do? Well, it uses very high heat, in chemicals, chemical reducing agents like coke, which is ultimately a form of coal. Okay, it's a processed form of coal, which we are going to talk about later in the class. And so coal has a lot of carbon in it, right? So does coke. It's got a lot of carbon. And what that carbon does is the carbon is oxidized. So it combines with oxygen in the ore, in that chalcopyrite, for example. Okay, it pulls the oxygen out of the ore ultimately. And so what it leaves you with is a more pure metal. Instead of oxidized copper, you end up with native copper. And there's a whole lot of other steps that go along in terms of refining and processing that copper. But that's one of the basic things that happens. And you can imagine, okay, so you take that copper from the coal, you combine it with some of the oxygen, you oxidize it, and then you remove the oxygen from the copper. And so then you end up with carbon monoxide, that's CO, and also carbon dioxide, CO2. Okay, and that's ultimately your waste, right? And you can imagine, okay, so what's happening? It's releasing, right, that material into the atmosphere. Okay, these are greenhouse gases, right? So this is the pollution, at least part of the pollution. There's a lot of other stuff that comes out of this too, but it's at least part of the pollution that's emitted into the atmosphere in the processing and refining of copper. Okay, there's a number of other chemicals that are emitted as well. Harmful chemicals, you know, whether it's in the tailings or otherwise through the refining process, and these include things like mercury, lead, arsenic, stuff that you do not want to interact with, at least in any significant concentrations, because they're toxic to humans and other living animals, etc. Okay. So we're kind of looking at copper throughout the world, where it's coming from, etc. This is kind of an interesting image. It comes from the Kessler and Simon book, which, by the way, is this one. This is one of the optional textbooks, right? But one of the images from that, it's showing copper, okay, millions of tons on the y-axis, and then on the x-axis, just a bunch of bars for different countries. And it's showing the ratio of copper that is mined as an ore to the amount that is refined. Okay, so some countries are mining copper. They have copper resources and they're taking it out of the ground. And some countries have refineries and they're taking that ore and then they're further concentrating it to something that's more useful. And you can see, for example, Japan is sitting here. They don't mine any copper. They have no copper resources that are at least economic, that are ore deposits, but they do have a lot of refining. Okay, and so they end up getting ore that's going to be transported. It could be from a place like Chile. You can see Chile is right here, one of the largest miners of copper. They also have quite a few refineries, which is why their bar isn't any higher here. But they might take copper that's mined in Peru, which doesn't have as much refining capacity. That might be shipped across the ocean to Japan, where it's then refined and then used in all sorts of, you know, industrial purposes, whether it's electronics, cars, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So the copper trade is absolutely global. It's as is going to be the case with a lot of the minerals and energy resources that we look at. Okay. So let's sort of wrap this up. One of the things that I want to be thinking about as we talk about individual minerals and sources of energy, whether it's hydrocarbon or otherwise, is what is it that's important to consider when we're looking at minerals and energy that goes into feeding the lifestyles that we live, right? The technology that we use, whether it's a car, whether it's a smartphone, whether it's a computer, et cetera, right? What are some of the things that are important to consider, right? And sort of want to just let you sit with that for a second. Think about it. Here's a list of things that we'll be bringing up for each of these, right? For a specific device like you will in your energy project, you know, we'll be looking at what limited resource, and in that case, resources, does that device use, right? In this case, if we're looking at a vehicle, we can now say something about copper, you know, is used to create a vehicle and also to provide wiring for a vehicle. Right, so that's one of the many resources that a vehicle uses. What is the environmental impact? We're looking at that in terms of copper, specifically in the Butte, Montana example, right? What is the social impact? What are the costs and benefits to the community in terms of jobs, you know, creating jobs, you know, and what are the costs, you know, when all those jobs all of a sudden go away when the mine shuts down? We're going to hear something about that in the CBS News video clip. And also just mention here, you know, this will come up when we talk about energy and we talk about oil and gas. But I mentioned in my introduction that I worked in Houston, Texas in the oil industry. And I was there when the Macondo accident occurred, the blowout, right, which was an environmental catastrophe. People died. Workers on the rig died. It was a tragedy on many levels. And what President Obama at the time, who was president, did is established a moratorium for drilling, which just said that no more drilling could occur in the Gulf of Mexico until they figured out what was the cause of this and how are we going to mitigate that risk? How are we going to prevent that from happening in future drilling? Okay, until we figured that out, he was saying we're going to stop any drilling. We're going to put a moratorium on drilling. And what was interesting while I was, you know, living and working in Houston was that what I noticed, and of course, you know, it's generalizing is always a little bit dangerous, but what I noticed is that the first communities that were advocating to stop the moratorium, right, to end the moratorium, in other words, to allow us to go back to drilling wells, were the communities that were also most impacted by the environmental catastrophe, right, that had happened. In other words, they were Gulf states that exist that border the Gulf of Mexico, Louisiana, Alabama, Texas. These communities were advocating to stop the moratorium, even though they were directly impacted by that environmental cost. And why is that? It's because they were employed, right, by this industry. It came down to these individuals' livelihoods. Right. And so they were like, hey, this is affecting my ability to work. It's affecting my ability to make money, to provide for my family, et cetera. And so they were advocating, the people most directly affected, at least, were advocating to stop the moratorium prior to others, which I thought was really interesting. So, yeah, that cost benefits piece, it's an interesting one and one worth discussion. It's not always black and white, right? It can be very nuanced. And then future consequences, right? What are the future consequences of us, you know, starting in the 1800s, starting to take a mountain apart in order to get copper out of it, right? And are we thinking about, while we're doing that, are we thinking about, well, what is the impact to the atmosphere in terms of all of the CO2, et cetera, that's coming out into the atmosphere? What is the impact to that area? Am I going to be able to remediate what I'm doing to the land? Am I going to be able to restore it back to its original condition? Well, oftentimes, clearly, that is not something that's being considered or was considered, shall we say, evidenced by the fact that we have these Superfund sites, not just in Butte, but in other places throughout the United States where you have you know, different types of energy, different types of mineral extraction that were occurring long before significant environmental regulation existed. And now we're paying the cost, in a sense, for some of those practices. And it's also very difficult to see into the future in terms of understanding, you know, limited resources. For example, peak oil, which was an idea that existed in the 70s, where it was thought that we were going to start running out of oil. It's a limited resource, and that based on our consumption levels, the supply was going to run out, and so we were going to hit this peak, kind of like a bell curve, and then the amount of oil that was going to be available and going to be used was going to start decreasing. That was a projection that was very popular, or popularized, I should say, that didn't come true. And why didn't it come true? Why were people wrong in predicting that sort of peak oil scenario? Well, it's because of technology, ultimately, which is very difficult to predict, right? It's very difficult to predict what technologies will be invented and come around in the future. In the case of peak oil, the technology were different enhanced types of oil and gas extraction. So people figured out, hey, I can continue scraping the bottom of this barrel and getting more and more of kind of the remnants of oil down there that I didn't think were available to me by using technology. For example, in Bakersfield, which I showed you a slide of earlier on in the class, I showed a slide that had some pump jacks and things like that in Bakersfield, which is a very old oil field. I mentioned that it's been active for over 100 years. The reason it's been able to be active for so long isn't because there's an infinite amount of oil in the ground. The reason is because technology has progressed to the point where they've been able to mobilize more and more oil that they would have never been able to mobilize 20, 30, 40 years ago, right? And how do they do that? Well, through enhanced production techniques like steam flood. Okay, what's a steam flood? Well, that's where you inject steam, literally very hot vapor, right, which is steam, literally water, into the subsurface. Why would you do that? Well, what you're doing is you're trying to warm it up so that the heavy oil, which is what's left after you take away the easy stuff, the really light crude oil, what's left is this heavy stuff that's like asphalt, right? It's real thick and tarry. It's hard to get that stuff to flow, right? To flow to come to the surface. Well, if you heat it up, it lowers the viscosity, right? It makes it more fluid. It makes it easier to flow. And so they started steam floods where they would start injecting steam in the subsurface. It would heat it up and it would make it so this tar was more likely to flow and then be produced so they can continue, right, producing stuff that they didn't think was available, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago until that technology was developed. Okay, I'm going to end it there. Once again, please check out the other two videos and then make sure you answer or go through the quiz on this subject. These quizzes are primarily there to just ensure that you're actually doing the work that you're going through and thinking about it and to ensure that you're actually working through the material. So yeah, I'll talk to you next time. Take care.